An important part of America's history includes trains and the railways. It was what expanded the nation, allowed people to travel to what was then new territories, and was the main way for products and cargo to be transported so businesses could succeed. Trains also played a huge role in political campaigns. Whistle-stop campaigns, as they were called, brought the presidential candidates to the people and at the same time brought different aspects of America to the candidates. The next guest with his new book documents the history of this one-time cornerstone of politics and campaigning. His book is Whistle-Stop Politics, Campaign Trains, and the Reporters Who Covered Them. He served as campaign manager, press secretary, and aide to both presidential and congressional candidates of both parties. His work has also appeared in places like New York Times, L.A. Times, Washington Post, elsewhere. Edward Siegel, how are you today, Edward?
Great. Good to be with you today, Chris.
And the website for the book, which is out as an e-book and is about to be released in your, if you're one of those traditionalists and actual, you know, right, brick-and-mortar books, I guess we call them now, paper and all that, then ink, you can find out more at whistlestoppolitics.com. What surprised me, Edward, is, and we've seen it in documentaries or bios of certain presidential candidates, that it's a familiar concept. I was surprised with how much it was relied on, how frequently it was used. Who would you say is the father of the whistle-stop politics campaign?
Well, the father would be William Jennings Bryan, who campaigned extensively for president in 1896. He traveled through 27 states, gave hundreds of speeches, and is estimated to have spoken to at least 5 million people. He really set the standard for what later became the traditional whistle-stop campaign train tour that presidents, presidential aspirants, governors, congressmen, even occasional mayor or two have rode the rails of campaign trains to victory in their election campaigns.
And those distances can range, as you said, from literally coast to coast to within the body of a single state.
And, yes, really depended where the trains were. In the early days, of course, there were not many tracks when the first trains were established in the 1830s. It was William Henry Harrison who actually campaigned by train, the first one to do so in 1836. And it wasn't a long distance. He went from Baltimore to Ellicott City in Maryland. But some campaign trains have gone for thousands of miles through dozens of states, and their candidates have spoken to literally millions of people. But as the train system grew in the United States, so did the interest and enthusiasm of candidates to campaign from the back of trains.
And I'm sure, too, for the people, it's a great way to draw voters because as opposed to a stream like we see today on the Internet, a campaign usually launches off of a video on YouTube. You can see the person. I mean, you might not be able to shake their hands, but you can physically see them and hear them. That had to be a good way to win some votes, at least.
Yes, it's what I call political eye candy. It was a great way and, frankly, continues to be a great way for candidates running for any office to connect with people, to build interest and enthusiasm, and generate news coverage. In the early days, of course, candidates actually could touch and shake the hands of people. They would sometimes get off the train at the platform at depots, circulate among the crowd, and then get back on the train. So it's a great way for candidates to connect with voters and voters to see, hear, and connect with the politicians.
And depending on the politician, they could make maybe unforeseen use of that physical presence. You have great stories like with Dwight Eisenhower putting a couple of planks of board of wood to use to demonstrate a point.
Yeah, that's an important lesson that today's politicians can learn. Eisenhower, when he was campaigning across the country for president in 1952, he had a length of wood about 3 feet long. It was notched in two places. He would display the piece of wood and say, "This is what the dollar was worth before Franklin Roosevelt became president." Then he would tear off a piece of wood and said, "This is what it was worth after he was president." And then he was left with a third of the original length of the wood and said, "This is what the dollar was worth after Truman left the White House." So it was a great way for Eisenhower just not to tell his story, but also to demonstrate and show his story. And that's an important lesson that candidates today can learn and profit from as well.
Starting with Edward Siegel with his book, Whistle Stop Politics, Campaign Trains and the Reporters Who Cover Them, whistlestoppolitics.com, the website, and you are listening to Issues and Ideas. You mentioned Roosevelt. Actually, both Roosevelts play roles in the history of whistle-stop campaigning. With FDR, though, that had to be a great assistance because of his being afflicted with polio. He can get to people a lot easier than bouncing back and forth in a car or another means of transportation. It got into more people in a greater comfort zone.
Yes, he put people at ease. He developed empathy throughout his career, frankly, because of his experience with polio and his experience working and helping people at Warm Springs Resort. And he was able to connect with people in a way that very few politicians today are able to do so. And you're right about his polio. Although a lot of people knew he was afflicted by polio, he really did not want to show that he had polio. And so he arranged his campaign train stops to be on the arm of his son, James Roosevelt. And he was able to figure out a way to move in sync with his son, so it looked like he was being escorted by his son, but not being, having polio, and did not need braces or canes or any other device. And it worked. People did not realize he had polio when they saw him, and it was a great way for him to connect and to be seen and to connect with voters. And it worked throughout his career. A lot of people don't realize that FDR actually, when he was running for vice president with Cox in 1920, he campaigned extensively by train across the country. And it was that experience that stood him in good stead when he ran for president in 1932 and throughout his career until he died in 1945.
Yes, I have a great story because the other half of this equation is the press who covers these campaigns. And it wasn't always a happy day for members of the press. That if you got left behind, it would be a little tough to do your job then, wouldn't it be?
Yes, in fact, so many reporters got left behind. Some reporters started what they called the Left Behind Club, and they would post a large map of the United States in the press car to show where some of their colleagues had been left behind because either the train left early ahead of schedule or the reporters were busy in the crowd talking to people for their story, or perhaps they were on the phone at the train station and they did not realize the train was leaving. So a lot of stories about the reporters who got left behind. And frankly, it was a very grueling experience for many reporters just to keep up with the whistle-stopping candidates. And I talk more about that in the book. One reporter said it was the hardest job in journalism to cover whistle-stopping candidates.
But at the same time, is there a mutual benefit with the society, I guess, that built up? Because this was, I started thinking about, there was a sci-fi show recently, I think on TNT, that Earth had frozen over, the remnants of mankind were on this one train that was just perpetually traveling around the Earth, and it was a whole society in that train. That's pretty much what these whistle stop campaigns are all about. You had a whole mix of people, a whole mix of purposes, a whole mix of, well, what can I get? What do I have to give to get what I want? And it was so much going on in these trains.
You're absolutely right. Campaign trains were a microcosm of the rest of society. They carried a lot of different people, a lot of different nationalities, religions, and so on. But unfortunately, the trains also mirrored what was happening in society at the time. And there were instances during the 1950s when segregation was so prevalent in our society where a black reporter, Alice Dunnigan, was the first black reporter to travel on a campaign train with Harry Truman. And after she got off the train to go to an event associated with a campaign, she was actually discriminated against and pulled out of an entourage of walking reporters. One of her colleagues came to her aid, got her back in line, and President Truman found out about the incident, visited her at her compartment on the train later, apologized for what happened, and asked her if she was all right and wanted her to tell him if she ran into any other similar instances. So, in fact, President Eisenhower, former General Eisenhower, campaigning for president in 1952, he and his staff arranged for their train not to stop in a segregated city overnight so that reporters would not be discriminated against when they tried to check into a hotel.
In the here and now with campaigns, they're as tightly controlled as possible because they don't want any mess-ups, slip-ups, disturbances, protests, whatever the case may be. That could not be anywhere close to a guarantee when it came to whistle stop campaigns. Who showed up is what you got.
That's right. It was a spin of the dice, and you never knew who was going to come. But that's why planning was so important, mapping out a route across the country or across the state where you wanted to reach the voters you wanted to connect with. Timing was important. Scheduling was important. It was not a matter of getting up one day and saying, I know, I'm going to campaign by train today. It would require time, energy, resources, money, and a lot of planning to make sure it worked the way it should. That's not to say, though, there was not some level of spontaneity on the campaign trail. Sometimes when the engineer or conductor or even the staff of the candidate would see a large group of people standing by the track, and they would ask the conductor to stop and an engineer to stop the train. And the candidate would make an impromptu speech, shake some hands with the people who had come and hoped they would just see the candidate, and they were often surprised that they would shake the hands and see the candidate in person.
Just to wrap things up, Ben, Edward toward the end of the book has a chronological summary in order of the different campaigns and candidates who utilized trains in their campaign. And you'll be surprised, first, how many, and second, how lengthy the list actually is. Would it be possible in the here and now, because certainly the money is there when it comes to political campaigns, really at all levels, would it be possible, feasible, and beneficial for a candidate, if they wanted to be noticed, to do something like this today?
I think it would be an outstanding thing to do for any candidate running for office this year to do. It would be great visual, and visuals are so important, of course, to generate media interest. It would help build energy and enthusiasm. There's nothing like the impact of a diesel train pulling slowly into a station to create energy and enthusiasm. And with voters come out, yelling and cheering and clapping, it would be a great event. And more so than any time in history, I think a campaign train this year could generate more press coverage than ever before. Why? Because of the prevalence of social media. Just imagine the hundreds or thousands of people who would show up to an event at a whistle-stopping candidate at their train station. They would be snapping pictures, posting videos on Snapchat, YouTube, Facebook, yeah. X, Twitter. So it would be a great way to get the word out and have a greater impression for the impact that a train has today.
You mentioned social media. If the candidate would stream the before, during, and after, and people would realize, hey, if I show up at the next stop, I could be on that stream. Again, that would just add to the turnout for, and again, are you going to win everyone over? No, but I bet you win a lot of people over, more so than you would with a cold, impersonal, generic sort of campaigning, which unfortunately the cookie cutter has become too much of the norm. These are so many great stories that Edwards compiled in his book, Whistle Stop Politics, Campaign Trains, and the Reporters Who Covered Them. If you are a train aficionado, which around here in Northwest New Jersey, we have all this talk about the restoration of the Lackawanna cutoff, this would take you back to days gone by, and maybe days ahead too, but things work out in that regard. If you are a political junkie, a whole host of great stories in political history as well. Find out more at whistlestoppolitics.com. Edward Siegel, thanks so much for the history that you're preserving and presenting in Whistle Stop Politics. Thanks for being here today.
You're welcome. I enjoyed the conversation, Chris.